So good morning. Let's start this press briefing of the Information Service here at the UN in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 24th of June. So I would like to start this briefing by reading on camera the statement attributable to the spokesperson of the Secretary General, which was issued yesterday night's Geneva time, yesterday evening in New York, which says, and that's on behalf of Stefan Dujarric, spokesman for the Secretary General. The Secretary General is deeply alarmed by the further escalation of the conflict in the Middle East. From the outset of the crisis, the Secretary General has repeatedly condemned any military escalation in this conflict, including yesterday's attack by Iran on the territory of Qatar. He further reiterates his call on all parties to stop fighting. The Secretary General urges all member states to uphold their obligations under the UN Charter and other rules of international law. And obviously, as you know, you've seen the news as we have. The situation is very fluid. There are lots of developments, and so I expect that we will hear more from New York when they wake up today. And staying on the Middle East, we have with us Tamim Al-Kitan, who is the spokesperson of the OHCHR, as you know, and he has an update on Gaza.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Desperate, hungry people in Gaza continue to face the inhumane choice of either starving to death or risk being killed while trying to get food. Since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation started operating on the 27th of May, the Israeli military has shelled and shot Palestinians trying to reach the distribution points, leading to many fatalities. Reportedly, over 410 Palestinians have been killed as a result. At least 93 others have also been reportedly killed by the Israeli army while attempting to approach the very few aid convoys of the UN and other humanitarian organizations. At least 3,000 Palestinians have been injured in these incidents. Each of these killings must be promptly and impartially investigated, and those responsible must be held to account. The killing and wounding of civilians resulting from the unlawful use of firearms constitute a grave breach of international law and a war crime. Palestinians across Gaza are suffering from hunger and the lack of other life-saving necessities. The Gaza Strip remains on the verge of famine as a result of Israel's closure and blockade, as well as ongoing unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian assistance. This adds to Israel's systematic destruction of local food production and the economy, as well as the repeated forced mass displacements over the past 20 months. Israel also continues to impose severe restrictions on the work of the UN and other humanitarian organizations, preventing them from bringing and distributing food, fuel, and life-saving assistance into Gaza. Only a very few trucks have been allowed in since the 2nd of March. We are seeing scenes of chaos around food distribution points of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and the few UN humanitarian convoys. Women, children, older and disabled people in particular are facing multiple challenges at these points and are potentially at risk of aggravated forms of exploitation and abuse. Israel's militarized humanitarian assistance mechanism is in contradiction with international standards on aid distribution. It endangers civilians and contributes to the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza. The weaponization of food for civilians, in addition to restricting or preventing their access to life-sustaining services, constitutes a war crime and under certain circumstances may constitute elements of other crimes under international law. The Israeli military must stop shooting at people trying to get food. Israel must also allow the entry of food and other humanitarian assistance needed to sustain the lives of Palestinians in Gaza in accordance with international law and humanitarian principles. It must immediately lift its unlawful restrictions on the work of the UN and other humanitarian actors. Third states have the obligation to take concrete steps to ensure that Israel, the occupying power in Gaza, complies with its duty to ensure that sufficient food and life-saving necessities are provided to the population. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin, and for this statement. Let me see. I'll open the floor to questions now. Let's start with Jeremy.
Hi, Tamin. Just to know if you have any information on the latest incident that we heard this morning, 21 people, I think, were killed during another distribution. So do you have anything related to that?
Thank you, Jeremy. I do not have information on that specific incident, but again, it illustrates this whole situation that we're talking about in Gaza that needs to end. Thank you.
Absolutely. Nina.
Yeah, thank you. When you're talking about the weaponization of food as a war crime, would you say that Israel is guilty of that war crime, that they are weaponizing food? And I have another question just on the chaos that you're talking about around the few UN trucks that have been allowed in, if you have any more details around that and sort of how, if that is also Israel would be to blame for that. Thank you.
On the first question, we are not a court of law. There should be proper investigations in these events. So what we are saying is that the aid, the humanitarian assistance, must never be used as a bargaining chip in any conflict. In terms of the trucks, we do not have specific numbers. Maybe our colleagues at OCHA can be helpful in that matter. But of course, as you know, the humanitarian assistance that is being allowed into Gaza is way less than the amounts needed.
Yeah, Jens is not with us, unless he's connected, but I don't think so. Otherwise, we'll try to get you an update on that. No, he's not in. I was looking if I had the latest numbers. The only thing I have here is that on Saturday and Sunday, the UN and our partners attempted to coordinate 16 humanitarian movements. Half of them were denied outright, hindering the tracking of water and fuel, the provision of nutrition services, and the retrieval of the bodies. That's the most recent number I have, but we can try to get more from OCHA. Sorry, Christian, Emma had raised the hand. Emma.
Sorry, I was multitasking. Did you answer Nina's question on Israel? Sorry. Were they guilty of the war crime of weaponization of food? I'm sorry if I missed it.
Yes, what I said is that our office is not a court of law. We do monitor the situation. So the qualification, the legal qualification, needs to be made by a court of law. But of course, the use of humanitarian assistance as a bargaining chip, for example, in a conflict must not happen.
Sorry, thank you. My question was on the 400 deaths near the sites. Have you managed to verify any of those yourselves, or are you using the UN human rights, health authorities' numbers? Thank you.
These are figures that have been verified by our office.
Thank you, Christian. And then, yeah, I saw you.
Thank you, Tamin. Can you tell us, are you in touch with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, are you talking to anyone there about their operations? Or are you in touch with the Israeli authorities to tell them, or the US authorities to tell them what you think about this operation? Thank you.
I guess that the position of the UN as a whole has been made clear that we are not part of this operation because it does not comply with international standards on aid distribution. But as you know, our office is not involved directly in the humanitarian assistance process because it's more for our humanitarian colleagues to work on that. Thank you. We, as office, we are not in touch with on that because it does not involve our direct work.
Yuri?
Yes, thank you, Tamine. J'aurais d'abord une question sur Gaza et ensuite une autre sur l'Iran, mais je pense qu'on attendra de changer de sujet avant de passer.
Comment ça avec Gaza, ouais.
Est-ce que c'est complètement une nouvelle tendance, le fait de tirer sur les points de sur les personnes qui se rendent aux points de distribution humanitaire? Parce que j'ai pas le souvenir que l'année dernière, par exemple, on parlait beaucoup de ça. On parlait l'année dernière du problème des gens qui essayaient d'évacuer des hôpitaux et qui se faisaient tirer dessus en évacuant, mais pas des personnes qui allaient chercher de l'aide humanitaire directement. Est-ce que c'est quelque chose de nouveau?
Merci pour cette question, Yuri. Est-ce que c'est nouveau? Est-ce que c'est une nouvelle tendance? En tout cas, depuis la création de ce mécanisme est nouveau. Donc, depuis la création de ce mécanisme, il y a environ un mois, on a commencé à remarquer ces incidents. Par le passé, il y a eu des incidents qui impliquaient des personnes qui cherchaient à obtenir de l'aide humanitaire, mais ce n'était pas dans le cadre de ce mécanisme parce qu'il est nouveau de toute façon.
Merci beaucoup et je prends l'occasion pour féliciter Yuri. That's a good news. We need it for having our second child. It's just second child. So congratulations for the double fatherhood. We need good news at this podium. Are there any other hands up in the room? I don't. Yes, sorry, Emma. No, there are more on the platform, but yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, may I ask a question on Iran to the UN Rights Office?
Let me finish with Gaza because there are more questions online. So, Nick Kamimbrous, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. I'm sorry, I missed the opening of your statement. Did you give a time frame in which the casualties that you've reported and verified, over what period of time those occurred? And secondly, do you have any information on the role of armed gangs in creating, also inflicting casualties? And what is your understanding of that dynamic? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. As I said in the statement, since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation started operating on the 27th of May, we have reported over 410 Palestinians who have been killed as a result of the Israeli military shelling and shooting Palestinians trying to reach the distribution points. As you know, on your second question, as you know, there is a sort of a breakdown of civil order in Gaza. And this is because of the destruction of infrastructure by the Israeli army. And there's also the targeting of civil defense members, police forces. So basically, we have a situation where there's a breakdown of civil order, and this encourages the appearance of gangs and can increase the criminality in the Gaza Strip. So we have seen these reports. I cannot say more on that. I do not have more on that, but perhaps we can get back to you if you need more information on this topic. Thank you.
Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Yes, thank you very much. Congratulations to Yuri. And well, I have some questions. So you are saying that Israelis are responsible of shooting people that wants to go and find food So that is a fact. So is that could constitute a crime against humanity to forbid people starving to get food and shooting them? And then my second question is, what you are seeing, your denounces and everything, are you sending these to international court or something? I mean, who is going to judge these crimes? Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriela. Your two questions are pretty much related. As I said, each of these killings must be promptly and impartially investigated, and those responsible must be held to account. These investigations that must take place can help determine the nature of the crime or the violation that has been committed. It is not the role of our office. And as you know, there are different international mechanisms which are looking into events that have been happening in the Gaza Strip. And this includes, of course, the ICJ, which is the highest court of the UN. Thank you.
Absolutely. I think we have exhausted on Gaza. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, is a clarification. In the notes that you sent, you say 410, 93 have been reportedly killed. So those ones are the ones that you have not verified. I guess that's why it says reportedly.
Yes, I can double check this and get back to you. But yes, when we say reportedly, the figures have not completely been verified by our office.
And Israel always says that it's Hamas who is shooting there. Can you exclude that? Because from your notes, it sounds like you are very sure that the 410 were killed by the Israeli military. Can you exclude that there were shots fired by Hamas or other organizations?
This cannot be excluded. The figure of 410 is about the fatalities caused by the Israeli army.
Thank you. No more question on Gaza, so I'll go back to Yuri. You had a question on Iran for Katia, for Tamin.
Yes, it is also about the data of the civilians that were killed, because we have some Iranian sources talking about a few hundred people that were killed. Humanitarian organizations on the field are talking about a height or more numbers of casualties within the civilians after the Israelians airstrikes. Do you have any data that is from your office that is confirmed, if we are talking about 100 people killed, 1,000 people killed, or you have no idea for now?
Thank you, Yuri. We do depend on, I mean, with the figures that we have are those that have been announced by the Iranian authorities. We know that certain NGOs say that the number is higher, but we cannot, we're not in a position to confirm these reports.
At the other hand, some Iran. Yes, Nina and then M.
Yeah, sorry, I was wondering if you could say, there was the shelling yesterday around Evin prison, and also there have been other instances where I guess the targets of the shelling have been less evident that they might be military targets. Could you say something about that? And do you have any information about the situation of the people inside, or what are your concerns about? I mean, the prisoners, a lot of them are political prisoners. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Nina. Evin prison is not a military objective, and targeting it constitutes a grave breach of international humanitarian law. We do not have specific reports on what happened. We know that there have been some fires inside the prison and a number of injuries. And as you said, there are a number of political prisoners, journalists inside this prison. Whether they are imprisoned, whether all the inmates are imprisoned arbitrarily for unlawful reasons, or that they are spending a sentence for crimes they've actually committed, they must be protected, and a prison, the Evin prison, should not have been targeted.
Emma?
Thank you. I was wondering if you could say a word about whether you're seeing any signs of a crackdown by Iran during this turbulent period. There are some reports of people being arrested on espionage charges. Do you have any idea what's happening? Can you quantify on what scale it's happening? Thank you.
Thank you, Emma, for that. It's very difficult to verify information coming from Iran because of the whole situation, as you know, and the lack of access. Now, we have seen these reports about Iranians being reportedly arrested for cyber activities and publishing content related to the Israeli attacks on Iran, according to NGOs. We have also seen reports of people being, nine men being executed in Iran since the 13th of June. So what we can say about that is that Iranian authorities must completely respect the rights to freedom of expression and information at all times. And journalists must be able to do their work without any obstacles. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamin. Gabriela.
Yes. Thank you very much. Two questions. If you can organize a press conference with the ICJ representative to talk about what we are talking about Gaza. And also a second question, does the Secretary General is in a direct communication with the US government? And what about the Israeli government, talking about this bombarding of the nuclear plants? Yes, thank you.
So on your first question, the answer is I can ask, but as you know, ICJ is not in Geneva. I can contact the spokesperson of ICJ to ask them if they can give a briefing, but I can't guarantee. I mean, and as you know, also the court is independent. I will ask. Doesn't hurt asking. On your second question, the Secretary General and his senior officials have been in constant contact. As you know, we've been saying this several times with the Israeli authorities, especially for what concerns the humanitarian aid, but also on the diplomatic front. And there is a constant contact with all the various people involved. I think we have been hearing the Secretary General saying this, and also the spokesperson. As we've said, anyone that can help should help, and we try to speak with all. Moussa.
Oui, merci beaucoup. Bonjour. J'ai une question sur Gaza. Je reviens à Gaza, Amine. Et c'est un follow-up sur la question de Christian qui a demandé sur la position israélienne. Donc, Israël, paraît-il, accuse Hamas de tirer sur les Palestiniens pendant qu'ils cherchent la nourriture. Si j'ai bien compris, vous n'avez pas exclu cette hypothèse. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous donner un petit peu plus de clarification sur ces points-là? Est-ce que Hamas tire les Palestiniens en train de chercher la nourriture? Une deuxième question sur les exécutions, ou bien les arrestations en Iran. Est-ce que ça concerne des droits de liberté, le droit d'expression, ou bien des collaborations avec Israël? Est-ce que aussi vous pouvez nous donner un petit peu plus de détails sur ce point? Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Moussa. Sur la première question, pardon si je n'ai pas été clair, je précise ma réponse. Il n'est pas exclu que d'autres sources de tirs soit présente dans ces endroits à Gaza. Je n'ai pas d'informations sur quelles sont ces sources-là, si c'est le Hamas ou d'autres groupes. Ce que je disais, c'est que le chiffre de 410 personnes que nous avons concerne des personnes qui ont été tuées par les tirs de feu de l'armée israélienne. Comme vous savez, Moussa, c'est très difficile de vérifier les informations qui viennent de la part de l'Iran de manière générale. Et donc, nous dépendons parfois des informations venues des autorités iraniennes. Nous avons des ONG qui disent qu'il y a des citoyens iraniens qui ont été arrêtés et accusé d'espionnage ou de collaboration avec Israël ou de cyberactivités diverses. Ces personnes-là doivent avoir tous leurs droits en termes de procédures légales et de procès équitables. Si ces arrestations sont arbitraires, ces personnes doivent être libérées immédiatement et sans condition.
Laurent ?
Oui, deux questions pour Tamine, une sur l'Iran et une après sur le Bélarus. Donc je ne sais pas si je l'ai fait les deux.
Je
ou
crois que c'était les derniers, donc tu peux poser les deux.
Ok. Sur l'Iran, est-ce que le Haut-Commissariat a une position sur la question du changement de régime ? Parce qu'on sait que ce n'était pas un objectif premier affiché par les États-Unis dans les frappes, mais maintenant le président Trump laisse penser qu'il ne serait pas opposé. Est-ce que le Haut-Commissariat dit clairement les Iraniens doivent être les seuls à pouvoir décider du régime politique dont il souhaite ? C'est la question sur l'Iran. Et sur le Bélarus, il ne me semble pas avoir eu de réaction du Haut-Commissariat après la libération de Sergueï Tikhanovski ce week-end et d'autres opposants du Bélarus. Est-ce qu'il y a une réaction ? Merci.
Laurent, I will answer your first question. Pardon, je passe au français. Ce qu'on peut dire sur ça, c'est que le secrétaire général a exprimé le fait d'être... Non, I'll switch to English because I can't translate. Sorry. Secretary General stands against any unilateral force that would make the situation in the region even worse and has condemned every escalation in the conflict. This is what the spokesperson said about the issue of the SG position on the regime change. You want to answer on Bélarus?
Merci pour la question sur la Biélorussie. Vous avez vu peut-être le tweet du haut-commissaire qui accueille, qui salue la libération des prisonniers et leur réunification avec leur famille. Pardon, je traduis de l'anglais parce que j'ai le tweet sous mes yeux en anglais. Le haut-commissaire réitère sa demande.
I think you can answer in English for Laurent, it's fine.
I can say it in English. He repeats his call to the release of all prisoners sentenced in Belarus on politically motivated ground. C'était le tweet qui a été publié par le haut-commissaire suite à la libération. Donc le 22 juin.
Always remember that neither English nor French are our mother tongue, so it's a little bit difficult. So thank you very much. Go ahead.
Hi. So on another subject, I was wondering, there's been the Supreme Court ruling in the U.S. Granting the right to expel people to third countries, not their home countries, and these are for migration offenses. If you could, what does that say in terms of human rights? If you have any comment on that, and I guess UNHCR would also be interested.
Yeah, we'll have in a moment the briefing from UNHCR, but Tamin, maybe you want to answer on the side of the High Commission.
Yes, thank you, Nina, for that. We have seen the news yesterday's Supreme Court order in relation to the deportation of non-nationals to third countries. The High Commissioner has expressed serious human rights concerns in relation to deportation of non-nationals, including to third countries. We reiterate the High Commissioner's call on the U.S. government to ensure compliance with due process and stop the removal of any individual to any country where there is a real risk of torture or other irreparable harm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gabriela, is this for Tamin? Can we let him go?
Yes, it's on the issue of migrants. How many Mexicans have been sent to Sudan del Sur? I don't know why. Sudan? Mexicans?
Maybe we... I don't know. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry, Gabriela. I do not have information on that specific issue. Yeah. Maybe our colleagues from the refugee agency can help. Yeah.
Sorry. I'd like to thank very much Tamin for this briefing and for updating us on the situation in Gaza, human rights in Gaza, and thanks so much. I'll ask Shabia also to come to the podium. While we are doing the change of speakers, I just wanted to recognize the students of the Elliott School of International Affairs of the George Washington University. Welcome to the... I would have liked to do it at the beginning, but let me... welcome you now, and Shabia, you want to sit here, please? So before we start the briefing by UNHCR, I'd like to give you a very bad news, among other bad news. Shabia's last briefing today, unfortunately, she's going to leave us, and I would really like to thank her very, very much for the incredible work that she's been doing for the Geneva Press Corps on behalf of the UNHCR. Thank you so much, Shabia. And we will listen to you and to your colleague religiously on the very important issue of the estimates, the new estimates of people in need of resettlement. So I welcome also Ms. Madia Ali Chengezi, hope I pronounce well. You want to start, Shabia?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very, very happy and sad to be here. It's so nice to be back in the press corps. I've been doing this job for the past 7 years, so it's going to be quite emotional saying goodbye. But anyway, I'll come to that later because there are many thanks to express and convey, maybe also offline. But yeah, we have some news for you today. In fact, something that's just been released this morning. You will have it in your inboxes. But 2.5 million refugees worldwide will need to be resettled next year, according to UN refugee estimates released today in its annual Projected Global Resettlement Needs report. While the figure remains high, annual resettlement needs have actually decreased this year, down from 2.9 million for the current year and to 2.5 million next year. And this is a decrease even though the global number of refugees continues to grow. So the decrease is mainly due to the changed situation in Syria, which has allowed for returns. And we are seeing some people pull out of resettlement processes in favor of plans to go home to rebuild. So for 2026, the largest refugee populations that will need to be resettled are Afghans, Syrians, South Sudanese, Rohingya refugees, and Congolese. And the main refugee host countries where refugees will need to be resettled from include Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Uganda. And we have numbers of the needs of the refugee populations and also of the refugee host countries in the report, which you will have in your inboxes. So refugee resettlement offers a concrete alternative to dangerous journeys. It helps preserve fragile protection spaces and showcases meaningful international solidarity with host countries. By offering solutions for refugees with high needs and greater dependency on assistance, resettlement helps ease the pressure on national systems and refugee host countries, and it also supports sustainable responses. In 2025, however, resettlement quotas are expected to be the lowest in recent decades, falling below the levels we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic, when many countries paused their programs. The dramatic decline in quotas risks reversing the significant progress made in recent years and can also expose refugees to more danger. So given the needs and that current refugee resettlement places remain limited, UNHCR is calling on states to sustain their resettlement programs and increase their intake. And we also ask for more predictable and agile resettlement programs and for adaptable quota allocations along key refugee routes. For 2026, the international community has set itself the goal to resettle 120,000 refugees. And recent history shows that this is achievable. While larger resettlement quotas remain crucial for achieving those goals, smaller quotas will also be equally important in the coming years, especially if cases can be processed quickly and reviewed remotely. For over 70 years, UNHCR has facilitated resettlement as a vital lifeline for refugees, offering solutions for individuals facing severe risks such as deportation, violence, medical emergencies, and other critical threats. And we will continue to do so. Last year, despite the challenges, more than 116,000 refugees were given the opportunity to find safety and rebuild their lives through UNHCR-supported resettlement. Every place is invaluable for those fleeing danger. So what I would like to do now is to introduce you to Madiha Ali Changezi, who is here with us, and we have the honour of having her today here at the Palais Briefing. Madiha is a former refugee who was resettled with her family, and she'll tell you a bit about her story. And after going through the experience of displacement and resettlement, she's now actually a practising refugee and human rights lawyer in her country, New Zealand. And she serves as one of the representatives of the Refugee Advisory Group to resettlement UNHCR supported resettlement programs. So Madiha will speak from her experience and perspective on the value of resettlement, and she has also been willing to do any media interviews should that be of interest. So I'll hand it over to Madiha.
Thank you, Shabia, and thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I speak to you not only as a lawyer and advocate, but as someone whose life was profoundly transformed by the power of resettlement. At the age of 14, I was displaced from my home and spent years in limbo, without legal status, without access to education, and without any hope for the future. Like millions of young refugees around the world, I grew up invisible to the world, to the systems that were meant to protect us, without rights, opportunities, and without safety. In 2018, my family was offered resettlement to Aotearoa, New Zealand. That one decision changed the course of my life. It didn't just offer protection, it restored my dignity. It gave me a place to call home, a future, and most importantly, access to my rights. Today, I'm a qualified refugee and human rights lawyer. I use the law to advocate for others who, like me, have faced injustice and inclusion. I also serve as the representative of the Refugee Advisory Group to the CRCP, helping to shape global resettlement policy. My journey is a living proof of what is possible when we invest in people, not because of what they've lost, but because of who they can become and what they can contribute to society. Despite immense challenges, refugee resettlement must be upheld by states as a vital and lasting solution. At its core, the case for expanding resettlement is driven by its undeniable humanitarian purpose. It is essential that states share responsibility and act collectively to protect those most at risk through long-term approaches that are grounded in human dignity, fairness, and inclusion. But resettlement is more than a humanitarian act. It is a strategic investment in our shared future. While refugees are selected based on protection needs, we are not defined by our vulnerability. Across the globe, resettled refugees are rebuilding communities, enriching economies, and strengthening the social fabric of their new countries. We offer solutions, We drive innovation. We launch businesses and fill labor shortages. We bring diverse experiences, skills, and a strong work ethic shaped by survival, adaptability, and hope. When provided with the right support systems and pathways to integration, education, employment, and community, we don't just rebuild our own lives, but also contribute meaningfully to societies that welcome us. Resettlement gave me the chance to complete my legal education and use that knowledge in the pursuit of justice. Multiply that across millions, and the long-term impact is extraordinary, not just for refugees, but for the communities that embrace us. Now, more than ever, we must reaffirm our commitment to refugee resettlement, not just by preserving existing pathways, but by expanding them with urgency and ambition. As global resettlement reaches record levels, resettlement must remain a central pillar of international protection. Resettlement offers a lifeline to those who cannot remain where they are. It is global responsibility in action, and it must be scaled, not someday, but now. States must not only sustain their programs, but expand them with urgency, with boldness, and with a shared recognition of what is at stake. Resettlement systems must be accessible, inclusive, and sustainable. The lives and futures of millions depend on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madiha, for sharing your experience and call with us. And thanks to Shabia, I'll open the floor to questions now. Nina? Nina Larsson is our AFP correspondent.
Hi, thanks for the briefing. I don't think we received that announcement, or I haven't at least, so it would be good if we could get that. And on the issue of resettlement, I'm wondering how the situation in the U.S. is going to impact that. Obviously, I think that that's completely halted, and that had been a very large, they had taken in a lot of resettled refugees previously. So if you could say something about that. And then I also had my other question that I asked previously, which was about the Supreme Court ruling. I don't know if you heard that previously about the deportation of third countries by non-nationals. Sorry.
Thanks, Nina. I think on the third country nationals, we'd probably have to defer to IOM, but we can also check with colleagues, but I think they might be better placed to comment. But on the resettlement program, yeah, I think our real concern is that we're seeing, as I mentioned, very worrying indications that the numbers of resettlement places are going to, are quite low. I mean, even surpassing perhaps or below the levels of the COVID pandemic. It's not just, one country, but I think we have indications that a number of countries are also, reducing or adjusting quotas. However, in saying that, at the same time, it's the states and the resettlement community, because resettlement is not just UNHCR, but it's states and other stakeholders involved in that. They have committed to a goal of resettling 120,000 refugees. So that is the commitment from the international community. So we're basically asking them to meet that objective. We are worried that the numbers are going to be the lowest. So that's why we're reiterating the call. I mean, at the same time, the needs are there. We have massive refugee crises around the world that are protracted, and others that are flaring up. So I think, it's in the world's interest to make sure there are solutions for people in these situations. So yeah, I think we have so far received indications of pledges for this year, but we don't have a concrete figure. We'll have to sort of wait till the end of the year. But it's also worth noting that last year, despite the challenges as well, there were about 116,000 refugees that were resettled, which is actually quite a significant number. So we'll have to see what happens year end and for the year ahead. But really, I think the call is for countries to increase their programs, and also not just the countries and the states that have traditionally large resettlement programs. It's also imperative that other countries step forward, even with whatever places they can offer, because you resettle one refugee, you can potentially change their life, their opportunities, and that of their families and others. We just heard from Madiha, and seeing her here today as a human rights and refugee lawyer, it's remarkable. And there are many other resettled refugees in similar predicaments and who've been able to benefit from that. So it's really a call for all countries countries to step forward and to increase their quotas, and also to make sure that these programs are flexible, that they can work based on wherever the needs are.
You have to unmute yourself, Gabriela. We can't hear you.
Yes, if she has some reports or something about migrants that are being taken to South Sudan, migrants that are or refugees that are in the USA that have sent to South Sudan, you have anything to say about that? Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gabriela. I'm not aware of that situation. We can double check, but I don't think we have anything to offer on that for now.
I don't see. Emma, sorry.
Shabia, I'm very sorry to see you leaving. I was wondering if you could say why you are leaving. I know this is an era of job cuts. Is that why you're going? Could you say a word on it? Thank you.
No, just for the record, it's
curious.
I know, I can imagine it coincides. No, actually, I was supposed to perhaps move on last year, but I was asked to extend, and I extended. I've been here for quite some time in the job, and I absolutely love the work that I did. I love working with all of you. I mean, I have to say the UN Press Corps in Geneva is, you know, amazing. The work you do, it actually helps change the lives of people around the world. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional because, you know, you cover the crises that are neglected and forgotten. And when we see the headlines and we see so much suffering, and having worked in those regions and in those crises, it makes a difference to be in the headlines. And I've seen that. I've seen that when I was in Yemen, when I was in Iraq. And it's, you know, having the power to relay the message of people that no one cares about, it's so critical. So you can actually advocate for so many things. And it's not just financial, but also changing policy. So please keep on doing the work that you do. I'm sorry, I'm so emotional. Now, I wasn't expecting to cry, but really, just thanks to you, and also thanks to the UN Geneva team. You know, they've done a remarkable job. We've been able to do so much with all the colleagues. They're just some of the most hardworking people I've seen at UN Geneva, and also my own team, some of them who are here, the news and media team. You know, it's 24 hours on the job, 7 days a week, responding to crisis, and many of them have worked in some of the most dangerous and difficult locations in the world. So we thank you for your support, and also, you know, members of the press who are committed to telling the stories and also holding those in power to account, because there are a lot of terrible things that are happening in the world, and we need to make sure there is accountability and that the stories of those who are affected, they have their voice relayed.
So, we thank you very much, very, very much, Shabia. We really do. We thank you and your colleagues for the incredible work that you do. We know you are all under strain, and we really want to thank you, and we are in solidarity with all of you. And thanks to our journalists to continue telling the story of refugees in their articles. And I see Gabriela wants to tell you something.
Yes, thank you very much, Shabia. Congratulations on your new endeavor. I don't know where are you going, but let us know where are you going, and we wish you the best of luck. And thank you so much for being so close to us and, you know, answer our questions as good as you can. So thank you so much. And then I just want to clarify something, that a Supreme Court of USA allows Trump to deport migrants to third countries. That is the thing. And so if you can later check on that and let us know what is happening with them. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think you have also answered Nina on that, so you will come back to, and we will also have to maybe ask the question to the colleagues at IUN. So thank you very, very much, Madiha, for being with us today and share your experience. Thank you again, Shabia, and good luck with your new, and kiss above all, keep in touch. I'd like to ask our colleagues of ITU now to come to the podium. Maybe afterwards. She's going to come. She has a little announcement at the end, so you'll be able to ask. But I'd like to welcome our colleagues of ITU, please, with David. Where's David? Oh. Yeah, thank you. Mrs. Black, if you sit on the other side, we see you better with the let her sit here if she has to speak because of the framing. Yeah, and you can sit on the left or side or right side. Thank you. So let me welcome our colleagues of the International Telecommunication Union. We have with us Gitanjali Saha, who's the Strategy and Policy Coordinator at ITU, and Bilal Jamoussi, the Deputy Director of ITU Telecommunication Standardization Bureau, with our own David. David, you want to start?
I'll start. Yes, thank you. And a pleasure to start by being able to say what really an honor it is to follow this podium with two incredible individuals, inspiring and also a tremendous role model, both of you. So thank you for what you've done and what I know you will continue to do to impact the world around us. In just about 2 weeks' time, ITU will host two events in parallel, that both focusing on digital technologies and global progress. The World Summit on the Information Society, WSIS Plus 20 High Level Event 2025, which begins Monday, 7 July, and runs through 11 July, which is a Friday, and the AI for Good Global Summit, which begins on Tuesday, the 8th of July, and runs as well through the 11th of July. Both events will take place at PAL Expo Convention Center. So that's a change from the past 2 years. Just to note that for the logistics involved, that both events will be at PAL Expo. Before getting to our events, just a few quick practical points related to that, similar to the practical points that we've given you before on these events, which is that media accreditation is open. A single badge is all that's required for both events. It's not the single UN badge that you're wearing right now. It is an event badge that we will issue, and we'll try to make that as easy as possible for you to get. We just do ask that you register online, and we'll be putting out an advisory later today that'll have a link. But regardless of which event, again, that you credential for, that event badge will be good for both. Also, given the logistics, and as in past years, also at CICG, we'll be offering facilities. There'll be work facilities for reporters who obviously come to cover the event and also wish to stay to plan their days around both the events that are taking a PAL Expo and also to be able to perhaps do some other work. So we'll make sure that you are made aware of that. We are hoping to have on the Monday, which is the opening day of WSIS, have a walkthrough through the facility where we can kind of introduce you to not only the facilities, but also to some of the participants of the at the events and the exhibitors. With that, I'll give the floor to our two briefers. Gitanjali Shah is a Strategy and Policy Coordinator at ITU. We'll talk about the WSIS Plus 20 high-level event, and Bilal Jamoussi to follow on AI for Good.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, David. Good afternoon, everybody. So basically, the WSIS high-level event is the annual WSIS forum. It was rebranded by member states and other stakeholders because it's a milestone event this year, WSIS completing 20 years of implementation. And it's just not a forum, but it's linked to a wider United Nations process, which was initiated in 2003 and 2005 to basically bring technology to the people. So it was a people-centric process, UN process, ensuring that they have access to digital technologies. So as part of this UN process, this WSIS Plus 20 high-level event 2025 will take place from the 7th to 11th of July here at PAL Expo in Geneva, Switzerland. It's co-hosted by the International Telecommunication Union and Swiss Confederation. The event is rebranded. Like I said, it's the annual WSIS Forum. It's a milestone event. It marks 20 years of the implementation of the WSIS process, a UN initiative aimed at promoting inclusive and people-centric information and knowledge societies. The WSIS Forum has provided a multi-stakeholder platform for promoting grassroots digital development, ensuring that the benefits of digital transformation reach communities across the world. The forum will bring together not only all stakeholders, but also high-level guests like 68 ministers of technology, 48 heads of regulatory bodies, several UN leaders, industry executives, and civil society advocates. Of course, the press is very welcome as well, from over 150 countries to explore strategies for maximizing the social and economic benefits of digital technologies for the wider benefit of the underprivileged and the unrepresentative all over the world. The key topics will include the digital divide, digital governance, including AI governance, digital skills, cybersecurity, ICT infrastructure, sustainability, and of course, WSIS Plus 20, the 20 years of the process and setting a stage for the next phase of global digital transformation, WSIS Beyond 2025. The outcomes of the event will feed directly to the United Nations General Assembly's 20-year review of WSIS scheduled for December 2025 in New York. So as we reflect on 20 years of digital cooperation, which is also going to be a main discussion here, what have we achieved? A people-centric approach, making sure that digital inequalities are addressed to ensure broad-based participation in the digital economy, multi-stakeholder collaboration that has been one of our greatest successes, that we cannot work in isolation. Everyone has to work together, and all stakeholders have to be part of the decision-making to basically respect the full diversity and complexity of the digital landscape. And agile digital governance processes. As technology keeps evolving at a rapid pace, we've built adaptable governance processes, frameworks like the WSIS action lines, which were adopted here in Geneva in 2003, that provide a framework of and cover the entire gamut of digital technologies and their impact on sustainable development. What have we achieved? In 2005, there were 1 billion internet users. Today, that number has grown to 5.5 billion. We've moved up from dial-up internet to 5G networks, dramatically increasing connectivity and speed. And more importantly, we've moved from fragmented efforts to multi-stakeholder collaboration. I wouldn't go into the details of the sessions, which you can find in an interactive agenda online. We have built it through a bottom-up consultative process, and that's how we build our agenda and program. But you will see that there is a WSIS prizes ceremony, bringing the national, regional, and international projects recognized. We had 973 submissions, 1.5 million votes cast to the process. So please do come and see the prize winners being awarded at the high-level event. So the outcomes and the follow-up, we will have a chair. The chair is Mr. Solly Malatsi, Minister, Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, South Africa. He will be appointed on the 7th of July, 2025. And this appointment, he will take over from Switzerland as the chair of the WSIS Plus 20 high-level event. The outcomes, we will have a chair summary, which will be again submitted to the UNGA overall review. And each and every session of the WSIS high-level event will be captured in terms of an outcome document, which will also be submitted to the UNGA overall review through the ITU Secretary General WSIS Plus 20 report. David, with this, I pass it on to you.
Good morning. So about the AI for Good Global Summit, it was established in 2017 by the International Telecommunication Union. AI for Good is the United Nations' leading platform for advanced artificial intelligence solutions that support sustainable development, ethical governance, and digital capacity building. Organized with 54 United Nations agencies and programs and co-convened by the government of Switzerland, it brings together global stakeholders to ensure AI benefits all of humanity. This year's summit, held at Palexpo from 8 to 11 July in Geneva, welcomes 10,000 participants from more than 170 countries, with 41% women and 32% representation from developing member states. This year's summit centers on four areas: AI innovation for global challenges, governance and policy frameworks, technical standards for AI systems, and for capacity building and digital skills. The timing is critical with breakthroughs in generative AI, quantum computing, brain-computer interfaces, autonomous systems. The need for global cooperation and responsible innovation has never been greater. The summit will showcase how these technologies can improve healthcare, disaster response, education, agriculture, and economic resilience, while setting international standards to guide these deployments. A key focus is bridging the digital divide. Targeted programs will build AI literacy, especially in developing regions. Youth-centered workshops and multilateral dialogues aim to equip the next generation with the tools to use AI ethically and effectively. We're honored to feature speakers from across the globe, including our Secretary General, Doreen Bogdan-Martin, the State Secretary of Switzerland, Martina Hirayama, the godfathers of AI, Jeffrey Hinton, Joshua Bengio, and Jan LeCun, leaders from WTO, Salesforce, Signal, Amazon, Mozilla, Sony AI, and Alibaba Cloud, plus artists and activists advancing inclusion through artificial intelligence. The summit highlights will include the AI for Good Impact Awards, the Youth Robotics Challenge for Disaster Response, the Innovation Factory Grand Finale for Startups and SMEs, an AI-generated film festival exploring ethics and society, an AI-assisted K-pop performance promoting accessibility, and a 20,000 square meter AI robotics exhibition featuring innovation like flying cars, autonomous driving, solar robots, brain-computer interface, and more. So AI for Good 2025 is more than a summit. It's a global movement working to shape a future where AI empowers people, protects the planet, and drives inclusive prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks to David and to Mrs. Saar. This is indeed something we all need, AI for good, and developing even more the information society. So, yes, please, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, so with Guomin Daily. Yes, yeah. I want to ask some questions to Mr. Bilal Jamusi. And the first question, what is the new highlights or key changes in this year's AI for Good Summit compared with previous editions? And the second question, we all know that the AI for Good mainly focus on the good side of AI. Will this year's summit also address the bad side? Some, for example, the deepfake. If so, what specific areas will these discussions focus on? The third question, what new technologies and achievements will this year's summit bring us? Will it result in a joint declaration or initiative like the AI Action Summit in Paris? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the questions. What's really different this year is the size of the AI for Good. In 2017, we only had about 500 multi-stakeholder participants. This year, we are in Palexpo because of the interest in the multi-stakeholder platform that the AI for Good Summit brings with 10,000 participants. And it expanded from 2 days to 4 days. So we have 2 days of the summit where we will be having on the main stage keynote speakers, as I mentioned, the godfathers of AI, some very inspirational speeches from governments, private sector, academia, researchers, and civil society. And then 2 days, 1 day is dedicated for AI governance dialogue, and another day dedicated for International AI Standards Summit. So these are probably the key highlights. In the Hall 3 and 4 in Palexpo, which you can basically put a big jetliner, you'll see hundreds of kids, youth from around the world that have won the national competition, and they're coming to Geneva to compete on the international stage. You'll see tens, probably 100 startups who won the competitions at the national level coming to Geneva. So it's really bringing governments, private sector, youth, women. It is the inclusive nature of the AI for Good Summit that's quite different. On the second question, last year at the AI for Good 24, the first AI governance dialogue, the main topic was deepfakes and the impact on elections. Last year was a big election year around the world. And immediately the ITU, the ISO and IEC launched a collaboration on multimedia authenticity to combat deepfakes. And we're very pleased that a year after, this year, we will be launching the first white paper on all the existing technical tools and standards to watermark multimedia content and to detect deepfakes. We will be having a policy training at the summit conducted by ISO, and we will have communication material, because part of the deepfake combating is the end user being able to identify real content from fake content using AI. What was the third question?
Sorry, I asked too much. too
outcomes,
many questions.
Perfect. Thank you. So last year, out of all of the workshops and sessions, we published reports. For example, the AI Governance Day ended up with a report that is quite downloaded and used around the world. This year, we will have the same. We'll have a report on the AI governance dialogue. We'll have a report, as I mentioned, on the deepfake solutions. We will have a report on the International AI Standards Summit, which is quite unique, where we have about 14 workshops throughout the week. And then on Friday, we have the outcome from all those standards workshop on cybersecurity, on AI, disaster risk management, and AI deepfakes and AI. So all the aspects of using AI for good, culminating in the summit day, where we will also have a report on that.
Thank you very much, Emma. Emma Farge is our Reuters correspondent.
Hi, good morning. I'd say that one of the highlights of my career, no exaggeration, was the humanoid robot press conference that you organized a couple years ago.
Loved it.
We loved that. Are they coming back, and have there been many changes in humanoid robots since? Thank you.
Yes, we will have some humanoid robots, but this year we'll have about 52% of the demonstrations will be in the robotics space. 30% will be cutting-edge AI, including limbs that help people that may have lost certain parts of their body that actually are connected by a brain-computer interface, so you can communicate with them. There is 18% of that is really on the brain-computer interface. These 100 demos throughout the space will demonstrate not only the humanoid, but many other robotics advancements.
I also wanted to ask about the flying cars. Any chance that Tesla's robo-taxi will be there and Mr. Musk?
We will keep that as a surprise. We do have confirmation from at least three autonomous driving cars from different regions of the world, from Europe, Asia, and North America. But would like to keep that as a surprise for you to come and see us at the AI for Good at Bell Expo.
They definitely will, and that really shows that you're going to have a great event, both at the WISES and the AI for Good Global Summit. Thank you very much to colleagues. Thanks to David. I see that Aurora has put the address for requesting the accreditation is pressreg@itu.int. And of course, David's team is available to help you accrediting. So thanks very much to our colleagues of ITU. I'll ask Francesca and Shabia to come back to the podium for the last announcements. Where is Francesca? Oh, there. I don't know, Francesca. You have already spoken, the briefing. I don't need to introduce you, UNESCO. So who wants to start? Francesca, we give you the start. So we'll have the announcement, and I'll open the floor to questions. Go ahead.
So thank you, Alessandra. The global fight against racism and discrimination calls for inclusive and collective action. In this spirit, UNESCO calls on the international community to take part in its multi-stakeholder efforts to foster more just and equitable societies. As part of this commitment, UNESCO, in collaboration with permanent mission, UN agencies, and partner institutions, is organizing the event towards the Global Alliance Against Racism and Discrimination. The in-person event will take place on the 26th of June from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the UNESCO Liaison Office in Geneva. This initiative offers meaningful opportunities for stakeholders to invest in long-term sustainable action aligned with their strategic priorities, while advancing UNESCO's missions to build inclusive, resilient, and equitable societies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any question to UNESCO? Just let me see on the platform too. Don't see anything, so thank you. Oh, yes, Gabriela, this is for UNESCO.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So, talking about discrimination, what is your message to President Trump that looks like, you know, his government is discriminating thousands of migrants?
So on this topic, I don't have any information, so I have to go back to my HQ.
Other questions? Yes, Emma?
I heard that the U.S. Review of International Organizations finished earlier for UNESCO, that it was a bit shorter than the overall review. I'm just wondering if you've had any feedback from the Trump administration on the support for the organization. No.
So the review finished in May, and so far we don't have other information, unfortunately.
Gabriela, is this a follow-up?
Yes, yes, it's a follow-up. So it must be really hard to criticize or say something about a state that is paying almost, you know, I don't know what percentage of UN agencies. So do you have an idea or how can UN be funded by maybe private states or, I mean, private enterprises, or I don't know, because it's very difficult because, you know, it's very hard for you to answer something about USA government.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Gabriela, frankly. I mean, the question of funding, it's obviously, I mean, it's a very complex one, and it doesn't mean, you know, one country, two countries, three countries. As you know, we have been saying repetitively, we have had a liquidity crisis for about two, maybe more year, but started really heavily in 2023. At that point, out of the 193 countries that are members of the United Nations, only 143 countries had paid. So 50 countries, 50 member states had not paid. The year after, in 2024, we did a little bit better. It was 10 more, if I remember well, for 2024. And this year, of course, we are still in the year. We are still receiving payments. There is a liquidity crisis, which is standing for a number of reasons we've already told you about, and we have implemented mitigation measures. So there is on one side the regular budget where we need every country, every member state to pay their due. That's one thing. And then we have projects, what we call extra budgetary funds that go to specific projects that are voluntary contributions. And then some member states may have decided to stop. It has been seen. We have already spoken about the consequences of these cuts. So I'm not sure what you exactly mean. Some projects may be funded by foundations, associations, other actors, but it's really an ad hoc issue, and I don't think any of us can give you a comprehensive answer. But every agency, I think, has spoken about the need for the regular budget to be, of each agency to be paid, and the consequences of eventual reduction of extra budgetary funds. Gabriela, I don't want to go into this discussion now. If you have a specific question for specific agencies, please ask them. If you have a generic question, a follow-up, please go ahead.
Yes. Only, Alessandra, if you can send us a link where we can see how much each country have been donated, and you know the programs, and if you have that information, I would appreciate. Thank you.
Yes, what I can share with you all is the link to the Committee on Contributions of the UN General Assembly, which lists the countries that have paid in full. We do not disclose, for evident reasons, contributions which are not in full, but those who have paid in full, and we thank them very much for their contribution, are continuously listed, are listed on this page, which is continuously updated, and I'll send the link to all of you. Thank you very much. Shabia, you also had an announcement. Thanks, Francesca.
Yeah, thank you. So just one last announcement about an event that's happening today at 1:30 at the Palais des Nations Conference Room 3, and it's on the margins of the 59th session of the Human Rights Council. So UNHCR, in its role as the chair of the board for the Women's Peace and Humanitarian Fund, is launching the fund's annual report, which is titled Supporting Women on the Frontlines, Advancing Peace. So the event is open to journalists, and we warmly encourage your attendance. It will feature the head of the Women's Peace and Humanitarian Fund Secretariat, Tony Ann Brodber, who will present key findings on the impact of local women peace builders and humanitarian actors responding today to the most urgent humanitarian crisis around the globe. And the event will also have interventions from women civil society leaders from Syria and Afghanistan. So if you need any more information, feel free to reach out to me or Eugene, who is here with us and is the focal point for that. But yeah, we'll warmly encourage your attendance if you can. And it's at 1:30, as I mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shabia. Nina, you had a question for Shabia, yeah?
Sorry, Shabia. This was for earlier. I'm also very sorry to hear that you're leaving. But I had a question about Iran and Israel and what's going on there and the impact it's having on the UN and your staff on the ground in the region. If you have any information about how people evacuations or also contingency planning, I know things are very unclear right now. But if you have any information on that, and that would go for anyone, also for Alessandra or anyone else who's here. Thanks.
Yeah. So it is worth remembering that Iran is. One of the largest refugee host countries in the world. So it has about 3.5 million refugees, mainly from Afghanistan. And so we did issue a statement. Hopefully you already received that. But it was also warning that if the conflict persists, existing refugee populations would also face renewed uncertainty and yet more hardship. So UNHCR is present in Iran and Israel and many neighboring countries. And we are arranging emergency humanitarian relief supplies in different locations, readying a response in case needed. But we're closely monitoring developments in Iran and assessing the potential impact on refugees and forcibly displaced people in the country and the region. And although global aid cuts mean that our resources are scarcer and our capacity to deliver is reduced across the world, we continue to work hard to prepare for and respond to emergencies and to protect and pursue solutions for refugees. But in Iran, we have offices in Tehran, Mashhad, Kerman, Shiraz, and Isfahan. And our work there includes maintaining inclusive services such as health, education, and social protection. I mean, we've been there since 1984 in Iran, but we don't have any, further information. Maybe, Alessandra, you want to talk about the evacuations, but...
Well, in general, what we need to say is that the UN will continue to stay and will continue to deliver its support to the people of Iran. In light of the security situation, the UN has decided to temporarily move some non-program critical international personnel, as well as the dependents of international personnel. The safety of all our personnel and their families in Iran is a priority for us. But we also have to say that humanitarian relief personnel must be respected and protected. Attacks must not be directed against them. The inviolability of UN premises and the immunity of UN personnel must be respected by all at all times. We will continue to monitor and review the measures we take as the situation develops. Yes.
Sorry, Alessandra. I was just wondering if there is any chance that, that you or anyone else has any more details just on the numbers. You say some, where they are being moved to, if there's anything more you can say about that.
For obvious reason, I cannot give more details than that. I don't know if other colleagues from other agencies may, but that is what I can tell you for the moment. Emma.
Yeah, it was the same question, but you're talking about Iran, right? Yeah. From Iran, yeah.
I have a few last announcements for you very quickly to conclude this long briefing. First of all, we have sent you the messages of the Secretary General for the International Days of these days. Today, as you know, is International Day of Women in Diplomacy. There is, you will see by walking at the Palais, an exhibition in the mezzanine of Building E. It's a photo exhibition called Not a Woman's Job, Women Leading in Multilateralism and Diplomacy. It's the fourth edition of this Not a Woman Job series, and it brings together over 100 photographs contributed by 60 permanent missions to the UN in Geneva and the Library Archives Geneva. It pays tribute to the diverse leadership of women across regions, generation, and diplomatic roles, from peace mediators and humanitarian coordinators to foreign ministers and heads of states. You also have the statement of the Secretary General for the International Day of Seafarer, which is tomorrow, and on 26th of June, the statement for the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. But I'd like to remind also that it's also the UN International Day in support of victims of torture. Press conferences to remind you on Tuesday. Today at 2:30, the OHCHR Human Rights and International Solidarity Call for Solidarity and Peace. They will present Cecilia Bayet, the UN Independent Expert on Human Rights and International Solidarity, will present you with this call for solidarity and peace, addressing the normalization of violence and Arctic militarization risk through indigenous people's example, including insights from the Independent Expert's visit to Denmark and Greenland. On Wednesday, 25th of June at 10:30, OHCHR will give you a press conference by the rapporteur, Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. On Thursday, 26th of June at 10 a.m., also OHCHR speaker Reem Al-Salim, the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, its causes and consequences, will brief you on forms of sex-based violence against women and girls and the concept of consent in relation to violence against women and girls. Also on Thursday, again, and then my very last point is about CEDAW, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. We will review the report of Afghanistan today, which will be followed by San Marino tomorrow and Chad on Thursday. Human Rights Committee will continue its work, reviewing the reports of Kazakhstan this afternoon and tomorrow morning, and Guinea-Bissau Thursday afternoon and Friday morning. And this is really all I had for you. If there are no final questions, I'd like to thank you very much for following this long brief. Oh, you're not on my list, Catherine, but you are very welcome to speak.
No, just to remind you that we have a press conference on Thursday. I understood there's another press conference at 10. You mentioned. It's not at the same time.
Don't have
I think
anything for UNCTAD here, but let's,
yes,
let's
we have one.
See.
It's going to be on AI and digital economy with our experts. It's a background briefing ahead of what has been announced as the AI for Good Summit and the WISIS Plus 20. So we will recap from a development angle what is at stake at these meetings. And just I will add that I sent to you this morning an email to register to our new online newsroom. It's very important for our work together, so please fill in the form and register again, because we will remove the former ways of sharing documents with you. So I'll send a reminder anyway by email later in the week. Sorry, thank you.
No worries. You were not on my list, but you're always welcome to speak. So just to underline for those who could not hear well, the press event on technology and the need to register for the UNCTAD newsroom. Thank you very much. We'll follow this up if there's a problem with the time. I'm not sure about that. Thank you so much for everyone, and have a nice afternoon. I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.